counterpart, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, said China and the United States should handle occasional individual cases in a calm and professional manner. Wang stressed that China has always strictly abided by international laws and will not accept any groundless conjecture or hype. In the face of unexpected situations, what both sides should do is to maintain steadiness, communicate in time, avoid misjudgment, and manage differences. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said it spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It accused U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as a pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing. The U.S. allegation of a suspected spy balloon flying in the sky of Montana has added to concerns that the already heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing would further escalate. Although balloons are a powerful potential surveillance tool, it is odd that Beijing would do something this provocative just before a key U.S. diplomatic trip, especially since China has been pushing to repair relations with the United States post-pandemic. Some in the U.S. say it is very likely that China has been using this technique for a while and that the United States was aware of it, but diplomatically chose not to respond. A U.S. Defense Department spokesman confirmed that such intrusions have happened before, saying it is not the first time that you had a balloon of this nature cross over the continental United States. It has happened a handful of other times over the past few years, to include before this administration. Some believe that the United States is spending a large budget on creating unnecessary hostility with China. Some others reason out that the tensions have flared up in recent years between the two, with Biden declaring that China is America's most consequential geopolitical challenge and competition between the two global superpowers is intense. After all, Washington and Beijing are already at loggerheads over a host of issues. That includes tensions over Taiwan. President Biden has antagonized top Chinese officials by saying on several occasions that the United States would defend Taiwan if China attacked a self-ruled island. One close ally of the administration said that although White House officials have walked back those statements, Biden is intentionally sending a message to China when he makes such pronouncements. But tensions between Washington and Beijing are not limited to that. The two powers have deep differences on other issues as well. The economic war between the United States and China, with the two countries having imposed tariffs on each other's goods, can be named as such. The U.S. presence in the South China Sea also adds to concerns that Washington and Beijing would be facing each other militarily. In the current situation, one small excuse would be enough for the whole world to wage another world war.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power. Amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan, Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate four new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to four more bases. Washington has currently five bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas. In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan, saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm, standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
Imam Rida Masjid, leading imam for Imam Rida Center, was Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo. We might say that it was only for Moroccan people, although other people who were interested in Sharia school of thought, including African people, they would go to this Islamic center.
And Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo was trying to extinguish the fire, but he was not unfortunately successful and he was martyred.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So the new series of the program, The Teacher, is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, philosophers, jurists, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam, especially the Shiite ones, who dedicated their life into spreading Islam and the Shiite Islam all around the world. For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the outstanding Shiite clerics and preachers of Islam, Abdullah Ad-Dahdo. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you. This episode, give us some details about the early life and the education of Abdullah Ad-Dahdo.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo, born in 1966 in Morocco, then moving to Belgium when he was a child and growing up in Belgium, going to the schools over there and learning French language. Then as a religious man, he started to get to know about Shia school of thought, and he was really interested to Ahlul Bayt school of thought. And he converted to Shiism. In order to complete his knowledge and studying on Shiism, he moved to Iran. Mm-hmm. And he went to some schools and he went back to Belgium, completed his studies in the university in Belgium. Again, he
came back to Iran in order to complete his Islamic studies in Jamaat al-Mustafa al-Alamiyya.
Oh, really? Was he a student of Jamaat?
Yes.
In Iran. Okay,
and
cool.
Then you might say when he went back again to Belgium, mainly Brussels, he started his Tablighi life as the leader of the Ahlul Bayt community, which is mainly for the Morocco people. Because in Belgium and Brussels, we have different communities. We have Iranian communities, Iraqi communities. Each and every of these communities, they've got their Islamic center. But Imam Rida Masjid, which was being lead, or the leading imam for Imam Rida center, was Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo. We might say that it was only for Moroccan people, although other people who were interested in Sharia school of thought, including African people, they would go to this Islamic center, and other people from other communities.
So
but
were,
mainly this community was for the Moroccans. People. Yeah.
So there were Islamic centers before Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo goes to Brussels? Okay, over there. But special centers for the Moroccans, people from the same country he was born, in Brussels, Belgium, and he was leading the Shiite center over there, isn't it?
Yeah, this is actually what I said. Imam Rida Islamic Center, or you may say Islamic, actually Imam Rida Masjid. Is one of the masjid for the Shia community.
Yes.
And mainly this community was the Moroccan people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdawi. Sheikh Ziyanian, let's get to some of his tablighi or preaching efforts over there. What are they, Sheikh Abdullah Dahdos?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my brother, dear Sheikh Mahdawi, mentioned, he started his tablighi actions and preaching activities after returning back from the second trip that he had in Iran and completed his Islamic studies in Jamaat al-Mustafa. Then he came back to Belgium. He started his tablighi activities and preaching activities in Brussels in Masjid al-Imam Rida alayhi salam. And he was not only giving lectures there. Besides giving lectures and inviting people, he wrote a book that is Al-Hurriya fil Islam wal Gharb. That means the freedom in Islam and the West. And also he was involved in publishing a magazine that was in French language. The name was Shu'a al-Hikmah and was welcomed by European people, Muslims, in some countries. That the subject of this magazine was some, you know, legislative or we may say theological issues.
Yes.
So he was a member of the World Assembly of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam and was invited to give lectures in different countries. He had many visits and trips to Iran to participate in different conferences and also in different countries. Another important point that we should mention about Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo is that he welcomed African Muslims and African Shia people that were living in Belgium. You know, sometimes in some centers and masjids we see in different countries that unfortunately, this is not common, but sometimes we see this, that some ethnic issues are involved and are, you know, entered into the mosques and masjids. Some people, they do not allow other nationalities to enter their mosques. This is not something, you know, acceptable by Islam.
Yes.
Of course it's few, but we should be aware that we should stand against it and try to erase it completely.
Isn't it sometimes because of the standards of the living of that Western country? Or the laws, for example?
No.
No?
It's rooted in the cultures of people.
Okay.
You know, we as Iranians, maybe we are more comfortable to
Have connection with the Iranians.
Yes.
For example, Iranians, Iraqis, Lebanese, Africans have their own communities over there.
Exactly, this is the case.
This must not be the case.
Yeah.
The communities must welcome each ethnic group too.
Yeah, So that's the point that Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo focused on and tried to invite African people who were living in Belgium and Brussels especially to that mosque and welcomed there. No difference they were from Morocco or from different countries. But, you know, maybe these people were not welcomed in different centers. And this was not a good point. And this is not only in Europe. In different countries, I have seen this, that some nationalities are more welcoming to their own, you know, friends from their own countries, not other nationalities.
Okay. Thank you, much, Sheikh Ziania. So, Sheikh Mahtavi, give us a picture of the Muslim communities and the Islamic communities in Belgium. Because Abdullah Dahto was working over there, he was active over there in preaching Shiite Islam. What communities do we have over there? How many? And give us some details about Islamic communities.
Okay. Actually, the population of Belgium is 11 million people. From this 11 million people, above 400,000 people are Muslims. And among this 400,000 people, something around 30,000 are Shia. And I've heard from some of the citizens who are living in Brussels, specifically Brussels, they are saying that Brussels is the same as the Qom. They are saying that Brussels is the Qom to Europe.
Really?
Well, because the actually appearance of the city is really looking like a Muslim country or Muslim city, because most of the women are wearing hijab and you see masajid here and there.
Okay.
Among the Shia community, with this population of 30,000 people, we have four masjid. This is besides Islamic Center, because as far as I know, at least Iranian community, they themselves, they right now they have three leading centers. That these three leading centers are not included under those masajid.
Okay.
So in such small city, for one community, as mean Shia community, to have four masjid, that is something big, specifically in the Europe. So before we get into the actually last scene of the life of Sheikh Abdullah, I think this is good to talk about the Muslim environment in that city. The time Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo got martyred actually is the peak time of ISIS.
Okay.
And we see how the activities of ISIS is going to affect other Muslim environment here and there. Doesn't matter if you are living in the heart of the Europe. Why? Because we have a big community of Muslims. So this big community, among their leaders, they are going to get effect. I mean, those negative effect of the extremism, which is being practiced by some sort of Muslims.
Okay.
And the result of this is the clashes and conflicts among Muslim denominations, for which we can see something like this happen.
That's right.
I think our brother will speak about that much better.
About the details of his shahada.
Yeah.
So he was martyred over there. And that's all right. You know, this ISIS look at the life of the Muslims all here and there, I think culminated and led into a kind of a separation, sedition, disagreement among the Muslims. This is how the Wahhabis and, you know, out of law, is better to say, or extremist Muslims look at the religion of Islam. And this is very much different from the peaceful talks and the efforts that people like Abdullah Dahto had in Brussels. Okay, so Sheikh Ziania, he was martyred. How?
Yes, he was the imam of the mosque at Ridha, and he went into the mosque for praying Salatul Maghrib. He was preparing the mosque for Jama'ah prayer, and suddenly the glass of the window was broken, and somebody threw a fire into the mosque, and the mosque was, you know, burned. And Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo was trying to extinguish the fire, but he was not, unfortunately, successful, and he was martyred. Of course, there are some, you know, narrations that they may say that one of these takfiri people entered the mosque and hit him by a hammer that killed him at the scene. Okay. But some others say, no, he was martyred by
the
flames.
The killer, the assassinator, was a takfiri one?
Yes, they were three people, takfiri people, that they were giving some slogans regarding takfiris when they were burning the mosque.
That's all right.
And there's a documentary also made by an Iranian director Regarding the life of Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdu under the title of Qognus, that
Phoenix.
In English, yeah, we call it Phoenix.
Yes.
And the title is, you know, good for him because Qognus and yeah. Phoenix is burned.
According to Iranian mythology or yeah, the Persian
and also
one
in
is
other, yeah, in other
in
myths.
Fire, yes.
And Phoenix is burned in okay. fire.
Yes.
And Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdu also was martyred
this
by
way.
Fire. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his soul and place him beside Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam and Holy Inshallah. Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Okay. His body was taken out to his homeland in Morocco.
Yes, yes, yes.
And he was buried over there.
In Tangier.
In Tangier, that's right. But the case is that the court of Belgium, we can say, imprisoned the assassinator only for 27 years, you know, because of the killing of somebody. But according to their own laws, you know, for 27 years for imprisonment. That's all right. This was the life of Abdullah Dahdo.
And he was martyred in 2012.
12, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. 10 years ago. That's right. During Namaz and the prayer time and Salat time, he was martyred and passed away. May Allah bless his soul. And may Allah protect all the muballighs, you know, and muballighas who are trying their best in order to preach Shia Islam all across the world through, this is my emphasis, through peaceful coexistence and peace talks and peaceful manners. And this is how the religion of Islam invites the other people into itself, embracing Islam through first recognition of the sources, recognition of the ulama, through tahqiq and through peaceful talk. There is no force, there is no killing, there is no assassination. And all these extremist groups and extremist, you know, actions that we could see by some groups are under the flag of Islam, but they are not Muslims. Believe me, these people are not Muslims. Thank you, Sheikh Ziania.
You're most welcome.
Sheikh Mahtavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, talking about Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdu. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ Shia and Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Vaccination, infection with SARS-CoV-2 and a combination of both provide varying degrees of protection. In this regard, we have provided an exclusive article published in the scientific publication Nature. Stay tuned for more. Three years into the pandemic, the immune systems of the vast majority of humans have learned to recognize SARS-CoV-2 through vaccination, infection, or in many cases, both. But just how quickly do these types of immunity fade? New evidence suggests that hybrid immunity, the result of both vaccination and a bout of COVID-19, can provide partial protection against reinfection for at least 8 months. It also offers greater than 95% protection against severe disease or hospitalization for between 6 months and a year after an infection or vaccination, according to estimates from a meta-analysis. Immunity acquired by booster vaccination alone seems to fade somewhat faster. But the durability of immunity is much more complex than the numbers suggest. How long the immune system can fend off SARS-CoV-2 infection depends not only on how much immunity wanes over time, but also on how well immune cells recognize their target. And that has more to do with the virus and how much it mutates, says Deepta Bhattacharya, an immunologist at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Tucson. If a new variant finds ways to escape the existing immune response, then even a recent infection might not guarantee protection. Omicron has presented just such a scenario. In late 2021 and early 2022, the main Omicron subvariants that were causing infections were BA1 and BA2. By mid-2022, the BA5 wave was gathering strength in some countries, raising the prospect that those who had already had one round of Omicron could soon be exposed to another. That are now providing a sense of risk of reinfection over time. In one study, researchers looking at Portugal's national database of infections studied vaccinated people who became infected during the BA1, BA2 wave. Analysts showed that 90 days after an infection, this population had high immune protection. The risk of becoming infected with BA5 was just 1/16th. That of people who had been vaccinated but never infected. After that, hybrid immunity against infection declined steeply for a few months and then stabilized, ultimately providing protection for 8 months after infection, the duration of the study. Another study looked at 338 vaccinated healthcare workers in Sweden, some of whom had a previous SARS-CoV-2 infection. The authors found that workers with hybrid immunity had some level of protection against infection with BA1, BA2, and BA5 for at least 8 months. Swabbing of these workers' noses revealed high levels of mucosal antibodies, which are thought to be a better shield against infection than antibodies that circulate in the blood. A study in Qatar compared the infection risks of people who had never caught SARS-CoV-2 with those of people who had had a previous infection with Omicron or an earlier variant. Both groups included vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. The results show that more recent infections provide greater protection than older ones in all cases. But because the virus kept evolving, the authors couldn't untangle whether those differences were because of waning immunity, the virus's growing ability to evade the immune response, or more likely, a combination of the two. Taken together, the studies suggest that hybrid immunity provides some protection against infection for at least 7 or 8 months, and probably longer. Charlotte Tallin says that's pretty good. Charlotte Tallin is an immunologist at the Institute in Stockholm and author of the Swedish study. Other data suggests that in people whose immunity arises only from vaccination, a booster dose provides relatively short-lived protection against infection. What about those who haven't been vaccinated? Another study in Qatar suggests that if the virus doesn't change, infection-based immunity against reinfection can last up to 3 years, but that immunity can fade faster if the virus mutates. The authors of the study data from unvaccinated people who were infected with a pre-Omicron variant. 15 months later, those infections were less than 10% effective at protecting against Omicron infection. And it is much riskier to rely on immunity from infection than to get immunized. But it's nearly impossible to apply the study results to predict an individual's risk of becoming infected in future. Immunity depends on a variety of factors, including genetic, age, and sex. And past risk of infection isn't necessarily a good predictor of the risk of future infection because new variants are continually arising. How growing global hybrid immunity will affect the timing and frequency of infection surges isn't yet clear. Neither is it clear how this will influence health officials' decisions about when to offer future booster doses. For people who are at high risk of developing severe COVID-19, it might make sense to get boosters frequently. Younger individuals without any risk factors who live in regions where the virus has been circulating freely may already have very significant protection that may not require as frequent boosters, says Luis Gracia, an immunologist in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Lisbon, and the co-author of the Portuguese study. Another option might be to give a booster when antibody levels fall below a certain threshold, says the scientist. Tallinn understands that how frustrating the caveats and uncertainty can be, but says that researchers aren't likely to pin down an answer anytime soon, she says. The virus is evolving so fast. What's true today might not be true tomorrow.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the standard of human dignity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the standards of human dignity in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that there are some standards which are set by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala about the human dignity, and we must have those standards, we must follow the standards. In the Quran, Allah has clearly said in chapter 49, verse 13, that inna akramakum indallahi atqakum, that certainly the most honorable person or the noble person in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who observes taqwa, those who are God-fearing. And this is the first and foremost standard for the human dignity, that taqwa is known as the main and the major standard for the human dignity. Therefore, when we want to live a life, an Islamic lifestyle, and we want to have this dignity, then obviously we need to have taqwa. We need to observe taqwa. We need to be God-wary. And for in order to be God-wary, the simplest thing is that the taqwa can be translated as to not to disobey Allah. Anything in which there is an disobedience of Allah, in which there is the disobedience of Allah, this is against taqwa. This is against being muttaqi. So therefore, it is necessary for every single Muslim who wants to have an Islamic lifestyle to have the taqwa. And the beautiful thing about the taqwa is that when we look at the Allama Tabatabai's views about this, he takes taqwa equals to the iman. He says that a person who is mu'min must be a muttaqi. We cannot have a mu'min without taqwa. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the standards of the human dignity in the Islamic lifestyle. We mentioned that according to the Islamic teachings, the main standard of the human dignity is known as taqwa or be God-wary. And the definition, the simplest definition of the taqwa can be done as not to disobey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not to disobey the God who has created us. There are other definitions, and that can be said that this can be securing our nafs, ourselves, from anything which is harmful for the humans. And when we say the things that are harmful, it means that Allah has made this clear that what things are harmful. For example, if alcohol is forbidden in Islam, it is because it is harmful. If the meat of like pig is, it's been forbidden, it is because it is harmful. If it is said that to eat animals that are allowable, which are halal, by taking the name of Allah on them and slaughter them in the Islamic way, if you do other than this, that is forbidden, it means that is harmful. Therefore, if it is said for our sisters to observe the hijab, if they do not, there is a harm in it. For the brothers to not to look at the namahram, if they look, there is a harm in it. So therefore, everything that we see in the Islam, which is halal and haram, it is on the basis of their being harmful and their being beneficial for the human beings. Therefore, taqwa means to observe the basics of the halal and haram in our life. If we can perform this, if we can have a life in which we are not disobeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then obviously we are the ones about whom Allah has said in the Quran that inna akramakum, certainly the noblest people amongst you are the ones near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, atqaakum, those amongst you who have taqwa, who are God-wary. And in Allah, alimun khabir, and certainly Allah knows the better. So inshallah, let's strive for the taqwa and practice taqwa in our lives, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Limelight. In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has warned that the country's problems are not going to disappear in 2023. We will take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has the details. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has warned of an onerous year ahead, stressing that the country's problems will not go away in 2023 after a tough 12 months. Rishi Sunak said he was not going to pretend that all our problems will go away in the new year, as the cost of living crisis and skyrocketing prices brought Britons under intense pressure during 2022. Britain's Prime Minister laid the responsibility for UK's worsening economic situation on the pandemic and the Ukrainian war. He said, "This has had a profound economic impact around the world and the UK has not been immune." The 42-year-old Prime Minister, who took charge towards the end of October following turmoil within the ruling Conservative Party, recalled his inaugural address on the steps of No. 10 Downing Street, reiterating his promise to work on the things that matter to Britons. He went on to promise continuing military and financial support for Ukraine amid Britain's economic struggles for alleviating the cost of living crisis. Thousands of workers in Britain have taken industrial action over low pay. Meanwhile, the leader of the opposition Labour Party, Keir Starmer, also acknowledged Prime Minister's remarks that it had been a very tough year for the country and said, "The United Kingdom needs to change." Referring to Conservatives' failure in national politics, Keir Starmer claimed Labour will attempt to build a new Britain that will fix struggling public services and grow the economy for everyone. A later message from Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves homed in on the wave of public sector strikes affecting transport and hospitals, and under government's reluctance to negotiate with the unions. Rachel Reeves told The Observer, "The Tories' approach is increasingly reckless in allowing these strikes to continue with no effort to resolve them. Sitting on the sidelines is now just another way in which the Tories are sabotaging Britain's economy." The Labour Party, which has been out of government for more than 12 years, is well ahead in opinion polls following the chaotic year under Rishi Sunak's Conservative Party. People polling had the Conservatives on 26 points behind in a survey for GB News released on 30th of December, with some pollsters giving Keir Starmer's Labour Party a lead of as much as 36 percentage points. The Tories must call a general election by January of 2025 at the latest. The United Kingdom has been grappling with a staggering economy for the past few months, with inflation rate rising to record high, causing the Bank of England to raise interest rates. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. A leading accounting company has warned that Britain's economy has already entered a protracted recession, which is set to last until the end of next year, bringing more pressure on Britons who are already squeezed by skyrocketing prices. According to the latest UK economic outlook published by accountancy firm KPMG, Britain's economy will shrink by 1.3% in 2023 amid continuing inflation and high interest rates. The international accountancy firm KPMG reckons that the rate of price increases will average 7% next year, an upward revision from 5.6% in their previous forecast. The report further predicted that the labour market in Britain will start deteriorating from the first half of next year. It said the rate of unemployment could reach 5.6% by mid-2023, up from 3.7%, representing an increase of around 680,000 people. Commenting on the KPMG's report, Yael Selfin, chief economist at KPMG UK, stressed that the increase in energy and food prices in 2022, as well as higher overall inflation, have significantly reduced households' purchasing power. Chief economist Selfin noted rising interest rates have added another headwind to growth. Lower-income households are particularly exposed to the mix of current price pressures, as the most affected spending category largely fall on necessities, with few substitutes in the short run. Selfin also called on Britons to avoid buying discretionary items in 2023 in response to squeeze on income. The chief economist at KPMG, Yael Selfin, added, "The current economic situation in Britain could make it harder for some companies to absorb any potential further economic shocks in the short term," adding that the supply chain pressures are likely to remain an issue in the background. The development comes after the Bank of England increased interest rates to a 14-year high. Currently, they stand at 3.5%, and it's expected to reach at least 4% by next spring. BusinessInsider.com has also covered the same story. Retailers failed to benefit from a post-lockdown boost in UK high street activity this year after soaring energy bills and the cost of living crisis forced households to rein in their spending. Despite an increase in face-to-face shopping after the lifting of COVID-19 restrictions, Barclaycard data released for the whole of 2022 showed retail spending fell 0.8% on the previous year. The debit and credit card company said the number of transactions was up this year, but the highest inflation in four decades had resulted in smaller basket sizes as consumers sought to keep track of their budgets. A 33% increase in energy bills resulted in consumers becoming more selective in their spending, with Barclaycard reporting people cutting back on subscriptions and home improvements. Britain's annual inflation rate already stood at just over 5% at the start of 2022, but was pushed higher by the impact on gas and electricity bills of the Russia-Ukraine conflict in February. By November, it had more than doubled to 10.7%, slightly below October's 11.1%. Energy bill misery is set to continue throughout 2023 amid warnings that the cost of heat and light and electricity will remain high for a decade. According to analysis from industry experts Cornwall Insight, gas and electricity costs are unlikely to return to normal until the 2030s. The average annual bill is set to rise from £2,500 to £3,000 in April, which means families and businesses will be paying more next winter. Analysts say the surge in bills can be directly linked to the Russia-Ukraine conflict and Britain's decision to stop buying Russian gas and oil. This means Britain has become more reliant on imports of expensive gas from Norway and through shipments of liquefied natural gas, LNG, from America, the Middle East and parts of Africa.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists, and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. Many of the things we learn are from the elegies that elegists recite, things that we have already told others many times in a simple language. But when the elegist or eulogist recites the same thing with a good voice and a good melody, it is as though we are hearing, understanding, and learning something new. It increases people's understanding. Of course, as a continuation of a program after a sermon. An elegy is not the same as a sermon. It has a different nature and reality. It gives understanding and stirs emotions. We must not underestimate the emotional factor. One characteristic that we as Shia have is that emotions are embedded in our teachings and imparting understanding from the beginning to the end.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is an accumulation of emotions. This is less in others. Our lamentations, elegies, supplications, and ziyarats are filled with emotions. They stir emotions. Of course, the presence of emotions is not beneficial in the absence of reasoning. The good thing about imparting understanding in the Shia text is that, in addition to stirring emotions, it also gives people a depth of understanding. This is a feature that I have not seen in the non-Shia. That is, as far as I know, I have not seen it. Of course, each one of the different religions, Islamic and non-Islamic, have certain things in them. But the peak may be seen in the Shia. I was once looking at the common supplications that exist among the non-Shia Muslims, which have been mentioned in detail in one of Al-Zamakhshari's books. I saw that, for example, if we place 10 lines of Imam Hussein's supplication for the day of Arafah, or supplication 47 of Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah next to those supplications, we will see these 10 lines have more content and greater spirit than all those supplications have together.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all. Guide me from all the ways
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
They'd warned the next one would be their biggest yet, and they've kept their promise. Tens of thousands of nurses from the Royal College of Nursing Union and ambulance crews on strike, this time together.
No nurses!
No nurses!
No nurses!
The chanting on the picket lines is not just about inflation-busting pay rises, but about the depressing state of the National Health Service. ICU nurse Neve has worked for the NHS for 10 years. It explains to us why she thinks the system is in crisis.
Total underfunding, a lack of foresight, I think, politically, and nurses really just being taken for granted for too long.
And that has meant tens of thousands of trained nurses either leaving the profession or working for the private sector in recent years.
They're calling out for the National Health Service to be kept alive, a system that is now on life support. And many in the medical profession believe that the deeper the crisis gets, the stronger the likelihood that privatization will be foisted upon them.
That's because while the NHS is at breaking point, private healthcare is flourishing, creating worries about a two-tier system, one for the rich who can pay their way, and another one, a subpar NHS for everyone else.
I hope that it isn't the case that we're moving towards a privatized system. I think it would be disastrous for all of us if that was the case. I think hopefully with these strikes, the public support that we've gained, the government will listen and see that that just isn't, you know, isn't an option. People don't want to lose the NHS.
If gestures of support by passing motorists is anything to go by, public support for the strikers is strong. It remains to be seen which side the British government will decide to be on. Saeed Pereza, London.
The closing session of the ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe was held in Tehran. During the meeting, the two sides stressed the importance of bilateral cooperation in the fields of agriculture, health, and facilitating exports of Iranian drugs into the Zimbabwean market. Iran and Zimbabwe officials agreed to use Iran's experiences in various fields, including the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, energy, and science.
Agriculture, exports of machinery, sale of petrochemical products, and technical engineering services are among the existing capacities for broader cooperation between Iran and Zimbabwe.
Speaking at the meeting, Iran's Minister of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare, Solat Mortazavi, said that the current level of commercial and economic relations between the two sides should increase to at least $500 million per year based on high potentials of the two countries.
The current level of commercial and economic relations between the two countries is not satisfactory, and the two countries should use their capacities to increase their volume of bilateral trade to at least $500 million per year. Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for almost 20 years, and Iran can share its experiences with Zimbabwe in various fields, including neutralizing the existing sanctions of the West.
Addressing the meeting, the visiting Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Makamura Shava, said mutual ties with Iran is taken to be very significant for Zimbabwe, stressing the country will definitely enjoy bilateral friendly ties with the Islamic Republic.
Zimbabwe and Iran are like twins who must learn to cooperate, because both countries have been slammed with sanctions by the West. And in this regard, the West hoped that Iran would go to its knees, Zimbabwe would go to its knees, but thank God this has not happened. So we are here to make sure that we turn the fortunes round and to say that these sanctions which the West imposed on us can be a blessing in disguise.
At the end of the meeting, several memoranda of understanding were signed by the two sides. According to Iranian officials, sanctions have become an opportunity to enhance production and improve human resources productivity, and that Iran is ready to transfer know-how and develop Zimbabwe's energy, transportation, tourism, medicine, and mining sectors. Salman Khujuri, Tehran.
Pakistanis take to the streets across the country on Kashmir Solidarity Day to condemn